Spark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.
CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Underrepresented music, local voices, and real people. You keep CJSF independent.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I was born in the city, way too late. People before me done their crimes. Now I'm living in too late times.
Europe has another war on its hands. The enemy in the summer of 25 is fire. Aircraft and firefighters flock to the south from all countries. Damaging and deadly fires are raging in Spain, France, Greece, Albania, and more. European leaders and media make clear the cause is climate-induced record heat and drought. More record wildfires are burning across Canada, coast to coast and in between. The North Pacific has been in a marine heat wave for months. Japan and Korea were unbearably hot. The Middle East is too, including Israel and Iran and Turkey, where fires rage. Some scientists say it is time to explore turning down the sun. It is called solar radiation management. Similar to the cooling effect of volcanoes, high-flying planes release sulfur particles to deflect sunlight and encourage clouds. Other experts warn of giant risks, things like monsoon failures endangering hundreds of millions. Serious people suggest solar radiation management may not work as a last resort. If we wait until 2 or 3 degrees of warming, various tipping points and unstoppable polar ice melt could already be triggered. Does that mean humans should try geoengineering now? All this is raised by one of America's most eminent climate scientists, Dr. Michael McCracken. He speaks with UK videographer and climate journalist Nick Breeze in a YouTube interview released May 15, 2025. With Nick's kind permission, I'm going to play that interview now. At the end, you can find some other points of view, plus a new song from Radio EcoShock, Too Late Times.
Speaking with Dr. Mike McCracken, a pioneering climate scientist whose research on atmospheric physics and global climate change has significantly advanced our understanding of human impacts on the climate system. His leadership roles at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory and the US Global Change Research Program established him as a key figure in climate science. As chief scientist for the Office of the US Global Change Research Program, he played a crucial role in advising multiple administrations on climate science and policy. In this episode, we explore counter and crossover views to opposition to solar geoengineering. With great respect to experts on all sides of this discussion, Mike offers some compelling reasons as to why we cannot just denounce proposals to cool the planet. This is at a time when the UK government is significantly funding research into solar geoengineering. With such a split in views on this topic, I hope you take the time to consider what Mike says and also what Professor Raymond Pierre Humbert says in a previous episode in order to inform your own perspective. In the next episode, I'll be speaking with Alexander MacDonald, a former head of US National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency, NOAA. who is the leading proponent behind supergrids for supplying the world with clean, abundant, and resilient electrical energy, without which all our dreams of the future will fail. Thanks to all subscribers. Please do like and share, and feedback in the comments. I do try to respond to all as much as I can. Thank you. Mike, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to me today. It's great to see you and get your views on this topic. Can you start by giving us your assessment of where climate is today, where we're going, and then in relation to solar radiation management, or SRM, how does SRM fit into a roadmap to the future?
I used to say we were having an environmental dilemma. Now I think we have a real pickle in the situation. Global warming is continuing. Emissions are going up. It's clearly related to human activities. To stop climate change, we have to not only stop increasing emissions, we have to get emissions to zero, which is something that really hasn't been done for prior technology switch. It's when you went from wood to coal, we kept burning wood. When you went from coal to oil and gas, you kept burning coal. We have to actually get to zero emissions of all of them to stop further warming. And it's now roughly at 1.5 degrees of global average temperature increase, which is the aspirational limit for the warming that was put into the Paris Accord. We're going to just go rapidly past that, perhaps to as much as double that amount, even if we're working hard at cutting emissions. Cutting emissions is clearly the way to go. We have to do that. Mitigation, we have to do that. But it's just proving hard to do, not just due to recalcitrance of governments, but there's just a tremendous amount to do and a real requirements for new approaches. So temperatures are headed up. And I guess I would say those of us who are pushing for intervention have a sense that we're as high as we want to go. We're already suffering tremendous amounts. Those of us in mid-latitudes aren't suffering so much, and we have access to air conditioning and other kind of ways to deal with the climate. But if you live in the subtropics, if you live in the equatorial regions, I mean, there's no way to provide air conditioning for all of those in India or all of those in Africa in any near-term timescale that matches what's going to happen with climate change. So we're in a really serious situation. The metric that is used in the international negotiations, this metric of global average temperature change, which is really average over the last 10 years of the global average, of the seasonal average, or of the daily average over the oceans and the land, is about the most innocuous metric you could think of in trying to talk about what the impacts of climate change are going to be for us. If you're in some areas in low latitudes, heat index is what's really terrible. We have high heat index in the United States and Texas. How do they survive? They go inside. They're in air-conditioned spaces. So that's the way to adapt to it. But we're also destabilizing ice sheets. We're starting having accelerated levels of sea level rise. And if you go back into the paleoclimatic record, which is sort of where I started way back in my dissertation days long ago, you see that the potential for sea level rise is huge. I mean, it could be meter or meters per century with the warming that we're having. That occurred in the past, so it's not something that couldn't occur now. So we're changing the climate. I guess the big difference with us, or disagreement or exception that we take with the traditional view is, the traditional view is right now is sort of that, well, we can just keep inching up and we'll get to maybe 2.5 degrees C warming, global warming. And by then, well, we'll deal with it. Well, last time it was 2.5 degrees C, sea level was tens of meters higher than it is now. That's just an unacceptable consequence. So the notion of intervention is, can we do something to shave off the peak level while we really get emissions and everything else under control? Can we try and return to what some of us call a more healthy climate situation as it was in maybe the second half of the 20th century?
And you just mentioned how innocuous this metric is of using this sort of global average compared to the pre-industrial period. Is there a better way to express urgency? You point to sea level rise, heat index, and they register with people, but it's been very difficult to communicate urgency to the man in the street, to people who are just sort of going about their daily lives. Is there a metric that you've come across that's helped communicate that better?
Well, to communicate to the public, what we and other nations have done is try and do climate change assessments. What matters is the impacts to people, and so it tends to be more local than global. And so what you want to do is, if you live on the coastlines, sea level rise and storm surges are a key issue. If you're a farmer, changing the precipitation pattern and how you can grow food is an issue. If you're in some regions, it's heat, and heat index is the issue. And they've been having terrible kinds of situations in India and elsewhere with very high temperatures and the impacts that you have. In other areas, it's water resources. In other areas, you know, it's sort of your cultural identity. Are we gonna have sea level rise flood low-lying islands? What's happening in the Arctic? I mean, I was a part of the Arctic synthesis team for the first Arctic assessment, and it was really interesting what the people up there said. They basically said, climate change is destroying our culture. And we from lower latitudes were there, sort of there listening in the mid latitudes. They said, well, wait a minute, I don't understand. You're driving a snowmobile and you're working at an oil pipeline company or something. What do you mean that climate change is destroying your culture? And they would say this, and we kept listening. And it turns out to survive in the Arctic for thousands of years, as these people have done, you have to develop a culture where you share resources, you share everything. You go on a community hunt for a whale, or you go on for a seal, and you share them. Because if you're an individual hunter and you one year break your leg, you're not going to survive the winter. I mean, you die. So individualism in the Arctic sort of died, and their culture was not having money to buy things and exchange between individuals, but community efforts to gather food and bring it in and share it with widows. And then the widows would be helping sew the nets or something. And so it was a completely different lifestyle of subsistence living off the natural world and sharing the bounty of it. And so now you say, well, now we don't have sea ice. Well, I can't go out. That makes it hard to capture seals and whales. Okay, I can go out of boats, and now they're trying to get even power boats, or I can go out in kayaks or something. But it's much harder to do, because when you had sea ice, the whales and the seals, they had to come up for air. And so what did you do? You waited right there, just like the polar bears would wait right where there was a break in the ice, and that's how you did it. And they had these wonderful ways of knowing about nature. And so all these things are destroyed. If you tell people in one place, this is happening somewhere else, it doesn't really help as much as telling people about what's happening locally. But there are some global metrics you can look at. You know, you can look at how severe tropical cyclones are becoming more likely and more disruptive. Temperature change is different in different places. It's much higher than the global average in high latitudes. It's about double that on land and mid latitudes. And you say, well, temperature change isn't so bad in low latitudes. Well, wait a minute. That's because the heat that would raise the temperature is going into evaporating moisture from the ocean. And if moisture goes up into the atmosphere, it's going to come down more, and you get these drenching kind of flooding rains. And what do you do when you're in some of those communities and you have a meter of rain or something from a tropical cyclone? It's hard to imagine a meter of rain, but that kind of thing has happened, you know, in a day or 2 days of storms where do you live? Do you live on the coastal plain that's getting flooded? Do you live in the valleys where all the water's coming down? Do you live on the hillsides that slide into the valleys? No wonder they evacuate the area and come and become refugees and head to higher places that are richer and more developed and can take them in. For people, it's where they are that you have to talk about.
You talked about localization, and pretty much anywhere you go in the world now, people are seeing quite drastic changes where they live. I mean, across Europe, we're seeing pretty much not full-blown catastrophes, but severe flooding events more or less on a daily basis throughout the year. And we're 1.5 degrees, using that innocuous metric, we're 1.5 degrees above the pre-industrial now. We're going higher. You've already said, around 2.5 degrees plus. Floods, droughts, fires, food security, all these things are on the table. What would you set, using that same metric, as a safe, a place we should be trying to get to in terms of above the pre-industrial, in terms of, was it 0.5 degree, 1 degree, 0?
So with respect to global average temperature, the world was doing pretty well in trying to adapt between the mid and late 20th century. And at that period, the global average temperature was between maybe 0.5 and 1 degree Celsius. And so that's sort of where you want to go back. This isn't a precise knob. There's always going to be variability so it goes up and down. The aim is to get back into a range of conditions that are more easily adjusted to. Now, some of the talk when it's about intervention, I want to go back to pre-industrial. I don't know anybody in any country that really wants to go back there. They've basically tended to adapt to what was happening in the mid-20th century or latter half of the 20th century with respect to where food is grown, what crops are grown, what infrastructure we have. The one reason to maybe consider going back to lower conditions for maybe a couple of decades is to try and get the destabilization of glaciers under control. If you could get back and somehow get some of that heat out of the ice sheets that has gotten in there, that might help stabilize the ice sheets and the ice streams that are coming down. And you might say, well, maybe I'd do that for just a brief time. I wouldn't want to try and stay there, but I might try and do that for a while, because 20,000 years ago, at the peak glacial period, sea level was lower by 120 meters. 120 meters, just 200 centuries ago, it was lower. And for the next 120 centuries, 12,000 years, till about 8,000 years ago, sea level rose on average 1 meter every century. When the reconstruction of the global average temperature was going up on average 1 degree every 2,000 years, every 20 centuries. We went up 1 degree in one century. We're going to go up another, say, 2 degrees in this century. And you go, wow. The potential for sea level rise is huge. And during that period, about 2/3 of the ice that was up on land melted into the ocean. And there's another 1/3 left in Antarctica and Greenland. And that's another 60 meters. And if you go back way in Earth history, when it was different, but go back 30, 50 million years ago, there weren't really polar ice sheets. All of that ice was in the ocean. Well, if we're headed up to that global level, the consequences of having sea, even if it takes, millennia to try for all of it to melt, which maybe it does, that's just overwhelming on humanity. I mean, our whole economy will be spent on relocating people away from coastlines or something. So we have to try and stop the ice sheets. And that's a reason that a number of us think we don't want to go higher. Now, intervention is not a solution. Solution is to get the atmospheric concentration under control. But can we control some of the worst impacts by intervening is the question.
The previous guest on this podcast pointed out that even since the Paris Agreement was signed in 2015, the amount of emissions that we've added to the burden is in the hundreds of billions of tons. If you're going to go back to
1970s, 1980s levels for a 0.5 to 1 degree level. I mean, that's colossal, isn't it, in terms of the mitigation job that we're undertaking?
In addition to reducing emissions, an emerging approach is sort of called carbon dioxide removal. That's pull it out of the atmosphere somehow. This is what we sort of call in the United States a gigantic unfunded mandate. So who in the world is going to pay for it? And right now the costs are pretty high. The one hope is there are some ideas starting to emerge about how to pull CO2 out, not at a high rate, but at a helpful rate that won't be quite so costly. But they're also quite, you know, imaginative approaches for spreading around the world. It's going to be hard to get back there. That's why, of course, mitigation is so important. I mean, one of your previous speakers I know said going to intervention is like throwing in the towel. Well, a number of us thought about that, and we sort of listed more than a dozen reasons why those for intervention are for more aggressive mitigation. First, we want a healthy planet, so we don't want to go up there anyway. But second, there are limits to what you can do with intervention to try and offset it. You can't just sort of, oh, well, I'm indefinitely going to keep burning and I'll intervene more and more. There are limits to what you can do without having some other kinds of adverse impacts. And so you want to keep what happens in terms of emissions as low as you possibly can. And then what we want to do is actually keep the temperature off and the general climate and water vapor evaporation, everything that intensify the weather, keep that all down as we can to try and help make it so we're not having terrible impacts around the world, especially in low latitudes. I mean, I think what we haven't done in thinking about it enough, the information's all out there, but the goal isn't just to have a nice climate. The goal is to achieve something like the Sustainable Development Goals. That is, that everybody in the world has a chance to sort of live and survive and produce goods and have food and all the different Sustainable Development Goals. And if you look at the UN reports on this, we're falling behind on the Sustainable Development Goals. Climate change is making it worse. If you warm the oceans, the fisheries go elsewhere, or they aren't so strong, or the coral reefs are bleached away, which are the sort of repositories for biodiversity in the ocean. So you just lose more and more as you get warmer and warmer. And we really, if we can, want to try and keep it down while we deal with this other problem. We should have been dealing with the intervention, you know, long ago. I mean, in the U.S., it first came to presidential and congressional level consideration in 1965. The President's Science Advisory Council said this is a problem. It was recognized on the global stage not much later than that. It was scientifically recognized in 1896 by Arrhenius and even earlier by others. But, you know, it took a while to confirm the scientific objections to Arrhenius's hypothesis. And so we've known about it a long time. You know, we're a third of a century past the Framework Convention on Climate Change, which said we should limit emissions to avoid dangerous anthropogenic interference. And what's happened? Emissions are still going up. Still going up. And fossil fuels are still 80% as a source of global energy. That's huge. We've just been dawdling along, and so now those of us who live in Internet say we just have to go to the sort of last resort we have to try and offset some of the impacts and the warming that, while all the mitigation and all the carbon dioxide removal is done, that can be done.
You know, we're at this point now. I mean, you're saying that mitigation is critical, it should be, it's not an either or situation, it should be done as part of the mix, and greenhouse gas removal, there's no technology is there at the moment that is scalable to meet the challenges that we're talking about. So you're kind of left with SRM, whereas, is that how you see it, that we simply are left with this one intervention option because even the political headwinds are against you, all of us at the moment?
Well, there are two other ways to that sort of have to be mentioned. One is, can we adapt to it and build our resilience and just sort of live in a warmer world? And that seems that's something we're going to have to do as much as we can, but there are real limits to what you can do, relocating your capital like they're doing in Indonesia because of sea level rise and other kinds of things. Those are big kinds of things to do. Much of the population lives in coastal cities, urbanized areas in coastal cities. So there's limits to adaptation and resilience. And then the other one that former U.S. science advisor John Holdren used to sort of put there was suffering. You know, you could just continue to have an increasing number of these terrible disasters that are happening when we have hurricanes and stuff. I mean, it used to be that our infrastructure was put in, and here a typical standard was, well, I want to make it resilient to a 1-in-100-year flood occurrence or something. Well, if you look at some results that Jim Hansen and his colleagues have put together about the likelihood of very hot summers, for example, which is what you would worry about for heat waves in cities and the need for air conditioning. So he looked at observations. This is not modeling. This is just observations. He looked at observations in the mid-20th century and sort of found a point for this is the sort of 1-in-1,000 time of summer-long heat that would occur in land areas of the Northern Hemisphere. And he said, okay, I'm going to keep that value here steady, and then I'm going to watch is what's happened over time. But what's happened over time is by the time you get to the present, that particular condition is not occurring just one time in 1,000. It's occurring about 20% of the time, 200 times more likely for that kind of very hot condition in the past, to which our buildings were perhaps designed for. When Europe was rebuilt after World War II in some of those cities, they based it on conditions, weather conditions at the time. And so you didn't put air conditioners in every apartment in Paris or something like that, or London or wherever you want to go. The buildings there were built to the weather that was occurring. So you dealt with it by having windows on both sides, and the air could flow, cool air could flow through or something. But now you look at it, and you're getting these heat waves. And you want to have air conditioning. It's expensive, sort of more expensive than to put it in afterwards than it is to have done it early. And so we're having these changes and extremes that are going to put a lot of pressure on society, more and more pressure on society and people, especially in low latitudes, especially because the heat index matters, what the humidity of the air is matters. My dad was in heating and refrigeration. And if you want to reduce the dew point that comes up, the wet bulb temperature, once you get there, it takes about 20 times as much electric energy to run an air conditioning device to pull the moisture down 1 degree as it does to cool dry air 1 degree. Well, so if you keep raising this, the amount of moisture in the air that people are experiencing to above what are considered comfortable or survivable levels, this gets very expensive to do in terms of air conditioning in low latitudes and now mid latitudes.
There are a number of scientists and eminent people who talk a lot about climate change, and they're saying that with aggressive mitigation, if we could get the emissions right down by, say, mid-century or around that sort of period, then the level of atmospheric greenhouse gases will naturally start to come down quite rapidly due to carbon sinks. Is this something that you see as a viable path with aggressive mitigation?
Well, it's very interesting, and I've heard that several times. And there are some people, you know, who talk about the persistence of CO2 going out a very long period of time, and some that talk about this rate of removal. We don't have, you know, good observational experience of what happens when you have low emissions and how long it will continue. And so there's an actual difference in views about this. I mean, as we go down towards zero emissions, we're also going to be reducing the concentrations or the emissions of the short-lived species like methane and tropospheric ozone and the amount of black carbon that goes up in the atmosphere. And so the force, as we go down in emissions, the overall forcing is going to go down with all of these too. But when you suddenly reach zero, there isn't some new process that starts.